when it comes to antennas, I mean, the simple dipole, you think everything has been written and everything's been done, written by, invented by Heinrich Hertz somewhere around 1870. So here we are, 137 years later, and you think everything's been done with a dipole. Not true. Go to any good technical library, take a look at the December issue, 2006, the December issue of Antennas and Propagation, the monthly journal of the IEEE on Antennas and Propagation, the December 2006 issue, and you'll see a guy who has invented a variation of a dipole that you can build at UHF frequencies with printed circuit materials, and instead of the dipole being 3 or 4% wide at the 2-to-1 standing wave ratio point, that antenna is a full octave wide. He has found a way of modifying the design of a dipole. And he did that 136 years later, after Heinrich Hertz invented the dipole. I was working on an antenna last week for a client of mine, and I think I've come up with a slightly new kind of balancing structure for a dipole. We're going to do a little bit more research on the subject, and if I'm right, we'll be filing a patent on that one too. So, antennas are not quite as simple as you'd like when it comes to getting down to the nitty-gritty of understanding them, and I've often said that there's probably close to 5,000 kinds of antennas. You open up the fourth edition of the Antenna Engineering Handbook by Volakis. You have to go to a good library that's well-equipped in order to find the darn thing, because it's only been out now for a couple of weeks. Unfortunately, the book lists brand new for $175, but it's got something like 59 chapters, as I remember, and I think it's got something like 1,100 pages, good photographs, and so on. Volakis, V-O-L-A-K-I-S, John L. Volakis, from Ohio University Electroscience Laboratory, the fourth edition of Antenna Engineering Handbook. If you love antennas, you gotta have that book. It's a Bible. It's a Torah. It's got a little bit of everything in there on the subject of antennas. It really covers the waterfront. And the latest edition, they've added about 10 more chapters or 15 more chapters. It's got 89 authors, 59 chapters, and they've even added chapters on propagation, feed lines. 50% of the third edition was reworked in order to make the fourth edition. So there's a lot of change here. A lot of good stuff. So get yourself a copy of those if you're interested in the subject of antennas. I didn't say it's simple, easy to understand. It's got some basic theory chapters in the beginning. Each individual chapter is broken down to specialize in a particular type of antenna. Reflector antennas are one of the chapters. Microwave and millimeter wave antennas is one of the chapters. Television broadcast antennas is one of the chapters. Television receiving antennas is one of the chapters, and so on. Printed circuit or patch type antennas is one of the chapters. I don't know if there's a chapter that really gives you, yes, chapter 4 gives you a lot of information about dipoles. The best kept secret about a dipole is that by adjusting the length of the dipole, you're adjusting the exact value of the resistive component in a linear monotonic manner. You make the dipole short enough compared to a half wavelength, and you can make the resistive component impedance 1 ohm if you want it that low. Make the length of the dipole with reference to a half wave a little bit longer than that, and you can make the resistance component go up to 2,000 ohms easily. So by just adjusting the length, you can make the resistive component as low as 1 ohm and as high as 2,000 ohms. Is that a range? That's a 2,000 to 1 range of impedance by doing nothing but adjusting the length of the dipole. Chapter 4, if you understand that graph, will tell you how to do it. Or if you go to Tom Williams' website, WA1MBA, which is Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha, .org. .com, I think it is. Could be .com, could be .org. I keep forgetting. But you'll find it. Just Google WA1MBA and you'll get it. And at the bottom of his webpage is an article about impedance matching dipoles and Yagis. I wrote it. It'll tell you how to do it. Once you choose the right length to give you the resistive impedance that matches your 20-ohm twin lead, your 50-ohm coax, your 300-ohm twin lead, your 600-ohm open wire line, whatever the heck your feed line is that you want to match, your 200-ohm half-wave coax balance, whatever your feed line is, whatever your impedance is, you choose the right length, you'll get exactly that value that you want off that curve for the resistive component. In general, once you made the resistive component whatever you want, there's always some reactance left over. If the antenna is less than a half wave long, the antenna will always have some capacitive reactance. If the antenna is longer than half wavelength long electronically, it'll have some inductive reactance. If it's inductive, you put a shunt capacitor across the center of the dipole, adjust the value for the capacitor just right, and the reactance disappears, and the antenna is perfect. 1-to-1 standing wave ratio. So, you have the tools in your hand to make dipoles perfect. It doesn't matter if the dipole is an inch above the ground, 100 feet in the air, or buried in the middle of an array of Yagis that you have built. You can make the driven element, the dipole of that Yagi, have whatever impedance you want, and make it a perfect 1-to-1 standing wave ratio. There's no magic. There are people who think that, well, I'm using a such-and-such Yagi, the only way I can feed it is with a folded dipole. I'm feeding a so-and-so Yagi, the only way I can feed it, according to the manufacturer or to the article I'm reading, is it's got to be a gamma match. It's got to be a T match. It's got to be a whatever other method, a sleeve dipole type thing. However, you think you've got to feed it in order to do the impedance matching. It's not true. It's something you make whatever your mechanical favorite kind of matching network to your dipole is, whatever your favorite mechanical, weatherproof, or whatever technique for feeding the dipole, you can make that give a perfect impedance match to your particular transmission line system. And I've tried to get that article published in a number of magazines. They thought the subject is boring. They thought everybody knows how to do it. And therefore, they reject the article. So I'm publishing it on the Internet instead, because that particular article was not accepted. It's not exciting enough. Every one of us is going to use a dipole some large number of times in our lifetime. Getting a good impedance match to the dipole is going to be important to you. And up till now, that information has been kept secret from you. That's a secret we shouldn't keep under the bushel basket any longer. That's an opinion. Let's see. I'm gonna go out and give a little bit of space right now. If anybody's got any further questions, if they want to add their name to the list, and we'll try to address them. If not, I'll go over to Paul. He's going to give us the latest space report. Then we'll go over to Mel. He's going to give us the latest emails he's received. He only gets one or two of them. That's a joke. He's going to choose a few of them, and we're going to try to address them. So, first of all, anybody with any further questions, you want your name on the list, give me your call letter's name, and a confirming yes right now.
And WS2N, Dick, can I give the space report? And I do have a few things I have to take care of later this evening.
There's nobody else answering right now? Paul, you got the floor.
Okay, yeah, I didn't hear anybody key up. Very good. Dick, not really that much. The Dawn spacecraft, which I highlighted for the last 2 weeks, that's the one that's going to eventually orbit the asteroids Ceres and Vesta in the asteroid belt, was supposed to take off, 15th was last date. It was supposed to take off a week or so ago, but it got delayed. It was lightning of the pad, and it was a fueling issue. They were worried that the lightning might be a problem with the fueling. They don't want to ignite anything. So that was delayed, and it was supposed to take off today. And now they've delayed that until September. So I guess we'll talk about that again in September. They want to make that pad clear. They want to clear things out. They just have two other missions one from that pad, in particular the Phoenix mission, and of course the Endeavour, which will be taking off on the 7th of August. A little busy time now. They missed their window. They'd rather wait until September for the Dawn mission. Do you know about the Phoenix mission? That's a nice little mission to follow over the next year, Dick. Have you heard about that?
I think you should tell us. What is the Phoenix mission, Paul? Go right ahead.
Okay, the Phoenix Mars mission is going to take off from the same pad the Dawn spacecraft was on. It's going to be leaving August 7th, and it's an 8-month mission to get to Mars. It is a landing mission. It is not a rover mission. It's going to land in the far northern hemisphere of Mars, hopefully into the pole area where there's ice under that northern pole. I think it is, in the wintertime you have, maybe a meter or two of carbon dioxide, frozen state there. But you also have frozen water, ice under that ground. And this thing, it's a nice looking spacecraft. It's big. I mean, if you look at a man standing next to it, I mean, this thing is huge. It's got a good size diameter to it, probably about 8-9 feet diameter. Got a robotic arm on it. It's not a rover. It's going to land. It's going to have thrusters on it to land. It's not an airbag mission. It's too big for that. It's not going to bounce and roll. So it's a soft landing. It's got a scoop on it. This thing is 8 feet long, so it can reach out really far. It could dig down maybe a foot and a half into the ground. And they expect it to be a hard ground, so they tested this thing in the desert where it's pretty hard to dig into the ground. And, no problem. It took about 4 hours to go down that foot and a half. So they figured the same thing for Mars. And it's got cameras on board, similar to the rover, stereoscopic cameras, which will look around and see where they're at when they're on the surface. That span's about 6 feet high. And they'll be taking soil samples and hopefully water ice samples and scooping it up and putting it into chemical testing hoppers. They're going to poke around and look for what's in there. So the mission is very well equipped. I mean, on the scoop itself, on the end of the scoop, they have a camera. So they could see right down to, a couple of microns or some minuscule number. They could look, a wide angle with the picture from the end of the camera on the scoop. So they can see what they're about to dig up or what they dig up before they put it in. That would give them a lot of information before they even put it into the air to get it tested. This is the first mission that when they come through their atmosphere, they have on board a camera which will be sending back live pictures. Usually when they come through the atmosphere, they get some telemetry, and that's about it. The last couple of missions, the Pathfinder and the rovers, they bounced a little bit. Then we get some telemetry. But this one, on the way down, is actually going to be sending pictures, which is good. I guess if it's a failure, they'll still have pictures. But it'll be looking at their landing area before they land. And they'll really have a good idea of where they actually landed this thing. One thing I like about it, on its descent, the Planetary Society put together a program and developed this imaging unit. Well, while they were at it, they put a microphone on board. This was supposed to be originally on the Polar Lander, which had crashed into the planet when that had gone. That was one of the failed missions. And now they're going to run it again. I remember we were talking about the Polar Lander. That was the first time they were going to have any kind of sound come back from another planet, which would have been interesting. And the sound you'll hear is probably the wind and maybe the mechanics of the thing working. But it's kind of a microphone on board, and they're going to send that information back. So something to look forward to maybe 7, 8 months from now, the cruise time to Mars. We'll be looking for that. It's got solar panels, it's got plutonium heaters, keep electronics warm, the batteries, recharge. So it's very well equipped. And I read a little bit about the chemical analysis. I didn't quite get that. I'll have to look at that a little bit more to try to figure out what they're looking for. I know there's two main type of chemical analysis that they're going to be doing of the soil and the frozen ice that they dig up. So interesting. It's derived from the original surveyor. They were going to send a Mars surveyor at one time, but that program was canceled, so they used a lot of the equipment off the shelf to try to keep the course down. Naturally, I guess because they reused all the equipment, they call it Phoenix, you know, rising from the ashes. And there you go, Dick. Back to you, WS2S.
Sounds like an exciting project. I know that Mars has an extremely thin atmosphere, like a 0.5% of the atmosphere that we have. But it sometimes blows at 200 to 250 miles an hour. So it's a very thin, very fast wind, and it's got enough velocity behind it to blow the dust off the solar cells of Spirit and Opportunity, those two rovers running around Mars, which are still operational, and I guess the last you heard, they're still going into that crater, which they may never get out of, but that crater goes down so deep that they're going to see the bedrock and the very early portions of Mars. So listening to the wind whistling on Mars could be fun, just like I want to install a microphone on the guy wires of my tower, because on a windy day, to listen to the wind whistle through the guy wires is a very exciting sound, or if a branch touches, of a tree touches the guy wire, it makes a very characteristic sound. Whenever anybody visits me, I sometimes bring them over to a guy wire, put their ear against the guy wire, and tap the guy wire with a metallic object. And you hear the pulse go up the tower, up the guy wire to the tower, and bounce back. And it gives a swooping audio sound. And you may or may not know that that's how they made the ray gun sound for Star Wars, by putting a contact microphone on a broadcast radio tower and tapping on the wire. And you take that sound, you speed it up and slow it down, and that becomes the ray gun sound, modified a little bit. It wasn't artificially produced in a synthesizer like a lot of people think it was. At least not on the very first Star Wars picture, with Harrison Ford and Pete Hamilton, is that his name? Yep. Good movie. Carrie Fisher. Mars missions. Boy, there's a lot of them. Not as many to Venus. Few to Mercury. Fair number of missions to Jupiter and Saturn. And now there's a mission on the way out to Pluto. So we're going to learn a lot about our solar system. When you go to the NASA website, you will discover, and you go to the right portion of it, they now are up to 230 exoplanets. In other words, there are 230 planets that have been discovered going around stars that are different than our sun. Some of them are two or three planets around the same star. So I guess we're talking about 110 stars and 230 planets. 200 stars and 230 planets. That's a lot of planets they're recently discovering. And the number is going up fast. And they're devising more and more sensitive equipment to do it. And as such, they're eventually going to find Earth-like planets. Up till now, the methods of detection have only found the really big things, like a Jupiter-sized planet going around real close to the Sun, where Mercury is in our case. So the Mercury orbit, Jupiter's, are what they've been discovering up till now, not because that's all there is, but that's the most easily detectable thing, because they're detecting the wobble of that Sun. And it's easy to detect the wobble when something is heavy in close. And it's a lot more difficult to get the very slow wobble detection of where Jupiter is in our planet. Right now, of all of those 230 planets, a lot of them could contain an Earth-like planet in size at an Earth-like distance from that Sun, and we can't yet detect that. Doesn't mean it's not there. Just haven't got the sensitivity to detect it, and they're working on that one real fast. I'm convinced it's just a matter of time before we find Earth-like sized planets around a Sun-like star, and that Earth-like planet is in the Goldilocks region, not too close where it's too hot, and it's too far where it's too cold. So the raw conditions by which our kind of life exists, we're going to find. Something like 10% of all the stars out there have planetary systems that we've already detected. And people used to think only one chance in a million do you get a star with sun, with planets going around it. That's what Frank Drake used to think when he wrote that equation trying to estimate how much extraterrestrial life there is. And his estimate in that particular parameter, his estimate was low by 100,000 to 1. He thought it's 1 in a million. It's 1 in 10. Exciting stuff going on with astronomy, as you can tell. If you have any doubt, any Wednesday night, except for the nights of New Moon, where they go to the Vanderbilt Planetarium, any other Wednesday night at 8:30, go to New York Institute of Technology and drop in on the Shore Center and listen to the Astronomical Society of Long Island. This astronomical club with 150 members is so active, they hold a meeting every single week. Not once a month, once a week. That's a group of astronomers. I've been a member of that now for 6 or so years. I own a great big, to me, 8-inch diameter Schmidt-Cassegrain telescope. I'm the guy there with the smallest telescope. The big guy there is John Vogt with a 33-inch diameter, or a 34-inch diameter, homebrew mirror portable telescope. And on the appropriate nights when he takes that out, you want to be there. That's a piece of machinery. To climb this A-frame ladder 10 feet off the ground just to look into the eyepiece of his telescope. But a 33 or a 34-inch diameter telescope, does it have images? And the biggest telescope homebrew anywhere in the world, there was a guy in Europe who built one that's 40 inches in diameter, was 43 inches in diameter. And John is looking now with real excitement at that particular design, saying, I can do that. And maybe go one step bigger. So you combine that with modern-day electronics that you put to the eyepiece of a telescope, which gives you 20 and 30 dB more sensitivity than you ever had with film before. And now you go to any of those members' websites and you will see photography that they've done of the sky, where the pictures are of a quality that the Mount Palomar telescope would have been proud to publish 20 years ago. These guys are doing that in their backyard with modern-day equipment. Okay, enough on that subject. Mel, I bet you've gotten an email or two. Let's hear about that. K2KEY, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Dick, one other show to watch, WS2N.
Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, The Universe, it's on the History Channel. It's been on every Tuesday at 9 o'clock. Very good show, and they keep running repeats different times during the day and night. So the Universe is a series that they've been doing. One day they cover the sun, next week they cover comets, next week they cover Mars, they did Jupiter, and last week they did the planet Earth. This week I don't know what they're going to do, I don't remember, but each week it's another topic. Don't know how long they're going to carry this on, but and maybe throughout the whole summer, I don't know, but the show's called Universe, Tuesday night, 9 o'clock, on History Channel. Just want to make that comment. Well, a lot of good information on it. Very, very informative, because they take one topic and they rip it apart, you know, and next week they do something else. So it's very, very, very good. If you don't have as long as you have cable, I don't know if you still get it through your satellite dish.
I should be getting it through my satellite dish. I've been so busy doing other things, I haven't repaired the power supply that feeds the positional motor and my satellite system. So my satellite system is stuck in one position, midway between two satellites, and I got nothing to watch. I got to fix that. And you're giving me more and more enthusiasm for doing it. Thank you. Okay, Mel, K2KEY. Did you get an email this week? Start off telling us, did you get to two or three, Mel? Go ahead.
This is K2KEY. How about 83, Dick?
Whoa, heavy.
Okay, I just say many of them. I just have to just pass over real quickly. The only comment, like I said, I did make a comment only on that radio that Joe had asked about the 718, just because I happen to have one in the mobile, and it happens to work, you know, quite well. But otherwise, I normally don't answer these questions on rigs. Boy, oh boy, I get a lot of them. Oh my Lord. To pay the fix, it's got this wrong, I got a quote of this much, this much, put this amount of money into it to repair it, blah, 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 on and on and on and on. So we'll just have to let them go. Products, new products, comments on new products, and we've evaluated this one, this product against another product. Oh, geez, you have no idea. So I could say I'm going to just pick out things that, you know, average amateur radio operators will be interested in. In fact, I usually pick out one from young people and, you know, just got their license or just getting into ham radio, and try to clarify a few points for them. I have one here. Okay, let's see. This is from Arthur. Okay, Arthur, let's see what you want to know. Impedance and reactance. Give me a simple definition to it. Okay. All right. I'll give you my simple definition, and then Dick can, I'm sure, elaborate on it. Impedance. We use the symbol. You've most likely seen it. Z, capital Z. And in simple words, it's the total opposition. When we have resistance and reactance in a circuit, is the opposition to the flow of alternating current. In other words, this at radio frequency sets up this condition with what we call resistance and reactance. Now, what is reactance? You most likely see reactance. We use this symbol X. And it is the opposition to the flow of alternating current. We have capacitive reactance, which was usually the capital X with a little C, and that's the opposition offered by a capacitor. And then we have inductive reactance, which is X with a little L, and it's the opposition offered by a coil. That's why we call it inductive, and we measure both of them in ohms. So that's what we put together for the word impedance. That's the simplest definition. And just remember, it presupposes the opposition to the flow of alternating current. Can I make it any simpler than that, Dick? Over.
I like that. I'm going to add a few words to it. Each of us has got a slightly different way of looking at it. And Arthur is going to have the chance of listening to Mel's way of looking at it, listening to Dick's way of looking at it, maybe listening to Paul's way of looking at it. One of the first things we learn in electronics is Ohm's law. And so, V equals IR, or I equals V over R. So, if I have a 10-volt battery, and I connect across it a 5-ohm resistor. That's I equals V over R. I is current, V is the voltage, and R is resistance. I've got 10 volts, 5 ohms. I divide 5 ohms into 10 volts, and I end up with 2. And the answer is 2 amperes. So, a 10-volt battery, 5-ohm resistor across it, Ohm's law predicts that 2 amperes will flow. That's a resistor, that's a battery, and that's a DC circuit. If I had a pure inductor, and I had a inductor that has the right number of Henrys of inductance, such that it also acted as a 5-ohm inductor, 5 ohms of inductive reactance, and if I had a 10-volt signal generator, I'd put my 5-ohm inductive reactance coil, so to speak, across my 10-volt signal generator. Again, 10 divided by 5, 2 amperes will flow. At first, they seem the same. If I go up in frequency, since inductive reactance is a formula, 2 pi FL. 2 pi is a constant. L is a constant if it's a good inductor, and frequency is the variable. As I go up in frequency, the inductive reactance goes up. If I go twice the frequency of my first experiment, where my inductor reactor used to be 5 ohms, and now it's 10 ohms, and I put it across the same 10-volt single generator, but now the single generator is running at twice the frequency, I've now got 10 ohms of inductive reactance, divide that into 10 volts coming out of the signal generator, and now 1 ampere flows through the inductor. So there seems to be some similarity, except the inductor is frequency sensitive. And the capacitor does the same thing, but in the opposite direction. You go up in frequency, and the reactance of a capacitor goes down. You go up in frequency, and the reactance of an inductor goes up. The fact that they move that way allows you to make very interesting frequency selective circuits. One other thing you'll notice is that when you did the resistor experiment, if you did it with your oscilloscope, so you're looking at the signal going across the resistor, and with your second set of probes on the scope, it's a two-channel scope, you're looking at the current that flows, you would see a sine wave for the voltage, you'd see a sine wave from the current, and although one be a little bigger than the other, they would line up in time. They would be in phase. So a resistor, a pure resistor, gives you no phase shift at any frequency if it's a pure resistor. When you did the experiment with the inductor, you'd find the current is 90 degrees later. In other words, you've got your two channels of the oscilloscope. The upper channel is the voltage you're applying. The lower channel is displaying the current that's flowing. You'd have the exact same sine wave in both, a little bit different in amplitude, but the lower sine wave would be shifted to the right a quarter of the wavelength, so to speak, quarter of the sine wave. The peak of one would be the valley of the other. 90 degrees of phase shift lagging with a pure inductor. And with a pure capacitor, the current would be leading. It would come out ahead. But again, the peaks of the voltage on the signal generator and the valleys of the current where it goes through zero on the capacitor or the inductor line up. That's the 90 degrees of phase shift. So the capacitor has leading current, the inductor has lagging current. That's a pure inductor. And then one step more complicated, you could put a resistor and a capacitor in series with each other and put them across the single generator or in parallel with each other, and they follow a kind of a series law and parallel resistance law. But there's a catch. That phase shift means that you put an I in the equation. I stands for square root of 2. Square root of 2, to an electronic engineer, only means 90 degrees of phase shift. None of the mathematicians ever explain it that way. Whenever you put I's in there, it just keeps track of which one of the components is creating 90 degrees of phase shift. So if I wanted to put a 10-ohm resistor in series with a 5-ohm inductive coil, and I want to talk about the total impedance, the average guy does it with parentheses, so the impedance, Z, equals, open parentheses, 10 comma, I, 5, close parentheses. The 10 means the 10 ohms of resistance. The I, 5 means 5 ohms of reactance. And since it's positive, you know it's an inductor. So now you've got an equation that tells you the impedance of a 5 ohm inductive reactance and coil in series with a 10 ohm resistor. And with a little bit of practice with those kind of equations, you can predict what current will flow, what frequency response it'll have. The next step is to put an inductor and a capacitor in parallel with each other. And now you've got a tuned circuit that favors a particular frequency, which might be your favorite ham band, 3.7 megacycles. Or you can put them in series, and that acts as a rejecting device. If you put it across a coax cable between center conductor and ground, it'll reject that particular frequency instead of passing it. The exact same inductor and capacitor. The first time you hear this jazz, it's complicated. I know that. The way it's usually explained is I is the square root of minus 1. That doesn't give you a warm, fuzzy feeling. The I is there just to tell you with the equation on the page that there's a 90-degree phase shift. That's all it's really telling you. And you have to behave with the mathematics a little bit differently. But it's a way of keeping track of who's who. And so rarely is it explained that way. And maybe you want to add a couple of words to this, Mel? K2KEY, H-U-L-I-W on the TechNet.
Hey, this is K2KEY. Pretty good coverage of it. I'd rather not go much further with it, let them digest as much of it, and we can have to come back with some further questions. I'm sure I'll get an email. Let's see, what else got here? Oh, I got a number of emails here about ground systems. Gee, you would believe that I think that I've got about, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4. I think I've got about 7 here that are referred to something about things to do with grounding, Dick, over.
And the word ground is a very relative word when it comes to radio circuits. In the case of Con Ed circuits and LIPA circuits, 60-cycle circuits, and DC battery circuits, the word ground, or what the British called earth, is a little bit more clear. In the case of power wiring, we ground our equipment primarily for safety reasons, to make sure when you touch the chassis, even though there's some kind of a wiring error inside, because the chassis is grounded by the third wire of your plug that goes in the wall, the green wire. It's not called the return, it's called the safety, I think, among other things. Earthing, safety, grounding. Because that's there, in theory, the chassis can never become hot. We ham radio operators will put a good ground ride outside, and maybe we also connect it to the water pipe grounding of the house, and connect that to our rigs and to our antennas for not only human safety for shock potential, but also for lightning protection. If the lightning strikes your antenna and the lightning bolt is traveling down the outside of your coax cable, if your coax cable before it enters the shack is grounded with a good ground rod outside, quite possibly none of the lightning bolt gets into the house. So for lightning protection, that's the second reason we do grounding. And the third reason we do grounding is to do some kind of control of where the RF current flows. And here we get into a pretty ambiguous area, because to a HF signal and a VHF signal and a microwave signal, the word ground is a very flaky word. The right kind of an antenna, like for instance a patch antenna, a printed circuit antenna, could be mounted 50 feet in the air at the focal point of your parabolic dish. And as far as that antenna is concerned, that patch antenna at the focal point of your dish, it thinks ground is that sheet of metal that the patch antenna is an eighth of an inch away by way of the dielectric material. You've got a printed circuit patch antenna on an eighth of an inch thick copper clad board, and the copper that you didn't take away from the back of the board, it calls that ground, and it operates against that ground, even though that ground is up in the air, and it may not be really connected directly to Earth, although it might be through the coax cable. So there, to that antenna, to that UHF antenna, ground is an eighth of an inch away from the antenna. To the guy who's operating an 80-meter dipole, and he builds a lightning arrestor into his coax cable as it leaves the shack, and he's got this heavy piece of 6-gauge wire that goes from that lightning arrestor to the nearest ground rod, that's the ground for his system, the lightning ground. Lightning, in theory, hitting his cable, produces a big pulse of voltage. His lightning arrestor structure goes into the conducting mode and conducts that light bulb, that lightning bolt, through the lightning arrestor into that ground rod by way of that 6-gauge piece of wire. To a dipole antenna that you feed with coax cable, that dipole, if you feed it without a balance, you just directly connect the coax semiconductor to half the dipole, shield to the other half, the left-hand side of the dipole, so to speak, it thinks ground is the shield of your coax cable. And that particular ground is not a very good one. It will be launching currents back down onto your cable if you don't put a balancing instruction up there. And the word balance, you think there's only one or two kinds. There's about 15 kinds of balance. You go to the appropriate chapter book. Let's see, there was Microwave Theory and Techniques. The author was Ruthroff, R-U-T-H-R-O-F-F. Somewhere around 1982, I'm not sure of the year, Microwave Theory and Techniques, but with the name Ruthroff and the title I'm going to give you, Some Balancing Devices. That's the name of his article. And the word some is a real understatement. Mr. Ruthroff covered the waterfront with 15 different kinds of balance in there. Everything from bazookas and Marshan and there's a and half-wave coax and infinite and whatever, infinite beam. There's lots and lots of kinds of balancing devices. And what does a balun do? The word balun is a contraction of balanced and unbalanced. B-A-L-U-N, sometimes spelled B-A-L-U-U-N. Your coax cable is called an unbalanced transmission line. Used correctly, all the signal is on the semiconductor and no signal is on the outer side, outside of the outer conductor. So that way it looks unbalanced. Whereas a transmission line made out of twin lead or 600 ohm open wire line or ladder line, in theory you use it in a balanced manner. Put 1 volt on the right hand side of the balanced transmission line and you put -1 volt at that same instant on the left hand side. And the sum of the two is zero. So at every inch along that cable it is electronically neutral as a whole, even though at that instant the right-hand side is positive and the left-hand side is negative. Half cycle later, the reverse, but you see what I mean. If you're using it correctly, it is at every instant as a whole, at every distance, at every instant, it's electronically neutral. As such, used properly, the transmission line will not radiate. Only the antenna will. So there's lots of kinds of grounds. And grounding a VHF circuit where the antenna is many wavelengths in the air becomes a little bit spooky as to what you call ground. A vertical ground plane antenna thinks that those three radials coming out of the bottom of your station master antenna, it thinks that is ground. It's a relative ground as far as that antenna is concerned. It's the counterpoise. It's the shield that primarily stops the current from flowing down the outside of the cable. So this is not the whole subject of ground, but we've gone a little bit more than scratch the surface. Now back to you, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, yes, this is from K2KEY. All right, well, this is Jimmy. He asked a question. He says, of course, what happens is, he says, the antenna seems to work real well on 80 and 40 meters, I guess to 20 meters, and when I use microphone, very nice mic I have, I get a burning sensation, okay, and why is this happening, but if I put the stop mic on, I don't have any problem. Well, I see what's happening here. When he puts the newer mic on, a metal mic, it's got the metal, and that's what he's feeling, you know, the RF burn, whereas with the stock mic, it's a plastic mic, so of course the condition is still there. What's the condition you're referring to, Jimmy, is that at that frequency, when you get to 14 megahertz, you actually are getting to what we call an unground condition. In other words, what is happening, as Dick was just saying, there are really two fundamental differences between trying to make this as simple as possible as a DC and an RF circuit ground. So, basically, if we have a inductance, that's a piece of wire, the longer the wire, the higher the inductive reactance and the higher the opposition of the flow to RF current. So, if we have a situation like that, you do have a situation that when you get this to 20 meters, as Dick was explaining, it's fine in 80 and 40. The condition is not caused by the microphone. The condition is caused by the difference in the grounding system that you're using and why it's not working. And I see it's followed it up with a later email, I see again, from the same person, and you wanted to know about this artificial ground device that is marketed. And, well, all right, shall I get into that, Dick, about this artificial ground device, basically what we're looking at, and how basically it works? Over.
Well, if I've got a pain in my leg, and I take enough aspirin, I may be able to kill the pain. I haven't corrected the original condition. I just removed the symptoms. And so, with this artificial ground, you can sort of kill the symptoms, but the original condition didn't get recognized. Most of the time, when you've got a hot mic condition, there's something less than ideal about the antenna you're feeding the signal into. If your 20-meter antenna, let's assume it was a dipole or a 20-meter Yagi or a 20-meter ground plane, if it had the right kind of a balancing device, it would not allow current to flow down the outside of the transmission line. Your transmitter is making, we'll say, 100 watts. The 100 watts is flowing inside the coax cable between the center conductor and the inner surface of the outer shield. That's where the current is flowing down the transmission line. And that's a beautiful shielded structure until it gets to the antenna. And if you didn't use a Unideller or a one of these other brand names of W2AD, you know, I can't even think of the call letters right now, but the W2UN, what was that again?
W2AU.
W2AU, yeah. One of these balancing devices, which makes a nice mechanical structure for the center of the dipole. And if you look inside, there's a bunch of ferrite toroids wrapped on the outside of the coax cable inside of this white package, this white tubular package. It stops current from flowing down the outside of the cable. That's how it's getting into the shack 98% of the time. Yes, if you had a open circuit at one of the connectors on the back end of the transmitter, the transmission line, or the connector that goes to the bird watt meter, if you're using one, your standing wave ratio meter, or to your antenna tuner, if you had a poorly assembled coax cable connector, where the shield is not being properly grounded at the connector, that can also launch current outside of the cable. You're letting the signal leak out as if it's water on a leaky pipe, so to speak. But if all your pipe connections are tight, all your coaxial connectors, in theory, everything is perfectly shielded up to the antenna. And the surprising thing is, even if the antenna is 50, 100, 150 feet away from you, it is capable of launching current on the outside of the cable that comes back down into the shack and makes everything in the shack hot, or at least the rig that you're talking to. You could put this artificial grounding device on there to create a ground. I would rather see you stop the problem at the source. Either find the leaky connector or add the balance to the antenna. Force the antenna to be a balanced structure. Right now you're using it in an unbalanced manner. If the shield of the cable is going directly to one half of the dipole, that's the usual cause of a hot mic. And in the worst case, you can get a small spark that jumps from the mic. The D104 metal case of the mic right over to your lip, and it's unpleasant. K2KEY, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY. No, I can't do anything about the antenna situation. I understand it's reading between the lines. This is a sort of a stealth antenna, and this is the best you can do. As far as the grounding system and the antenna system, now, there is the gadget, yes, Dick, as Dick just alluded to. The gadget, again, like you said, taking that aspirin, but not taking care of, you know, will remove the pain, but it's not fixing the problem, you know, at its root. It's a patch, and what we're talking about is this artificial ground that is a device that is marketed. People with this kind of situation, in desperation, yes, basically what the artificial ground system is, you ask me what it is, it's basically what we call an LC circuit. It lets you, by manipulating the knobs on the box, it'll let you electrically link of the ground lead to your rig. And in fact, what it's doing, it's making so the rig is not hot anymore. Actually, it's making the hot point further away from the rig. So in other words, you see the rig as being cold. In other words, you're not getting that RF bite, you know, like Dick just mentioned. But it's placing the problem of the hot spot, I guess we can call it a hot spot of RF, still on that ground lead, but not at your rig. It's putting it somewhere else. I don't know. Did I say that right, Dick? Over.
Yes, you did. A series LC network is called a resonant network, and the electronic technicians will take a parallel LC network and call it an anti-resonant network. But they both resonate. But when you make the wire that goes from your shack down to a transmission line, that goes down to a ground rod, you might be in the second or third floor of a building, and it's a nice long piece of wire, and that piece of wire has inductance to it. But with this artificial ground structure, you're adding just the right amount of series capacitance and maybe some extra inductance, such that the combination of the real inductance of that wire from the ground rod up to your second floor of your building, in my example, plus the inductor that is added by the artificial ground, plus the capacitor that's in series with it, that's added by the artificial ground, they have resonated that whole structure. And a series LC resonator at the design frequency goes to 0 ohms. In other words, the point of contact of your artificial ground on your transmission line, it thinks electronically that piece of the transmission line is all the way down right at that ground rod. And if you tune it correctly, it'll think it's in the middle of the ground rod, 3 feet below grade, 4 feet below grade. Electronically, you have put it there. So properly tuned, a artificial ground can do a pretty good job. But there's a poor man's way of doing this. In order for your shack to be hot, not only is the antenna unbalanced, not only is it launching current down the transmission line, but most of the time, that transmission line itself has a length where it is resonant, quarter wave, three-quarter wave. It's got one of the resonances of length at your operating frequency. That's also a requirement to make the shack hot. There's two ways you can stop that from happening. Add another random length of cable. It won't be the right length anymore. And as long as you're adding another length of cable to stop it from resonating, go one step further. That extra length of cable you add, put a few turns in it, and tape it together. You've now created a series inductor. So by two methods that are very inexpensive, you're going to kill the RF energy that's on your rig and on your microphone. Add an extra length of cable, wrap that cable into a coil and tape it together or held together with tie wraps, and it's both a series inductor on the outside. The RF going down the inside doesn't know anything's happened. It's going around the corner, but it doesn't know that. It's going around a circle. The outside is now an inductor. That's a series inductor acting as an RF choke. And it's another length of cable stopping it from being a resonant lens. The combination is going to cure the problem. You could take the Cadillac approach and use the very fancy aspirin, ibuprofen, that's called artificial ground. I'd rather see you add a random length of cable and put it into a coil. You're going to get a lot more for your money. And if you really want to go hell bent, you can do both. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, Roger. This is K2KEY. Yeah, there's a number of methods, of course. There's a couple of companies that one particular that markets the choke, and they actually call it for hunting chokes that they sell for hunting an unground or solving RF feedback problems. And they will, this, I don't want to know if I should mention the company, but they give you a whole bunch of instructions on how to go about installing the coax, on the coax, and all how to install these toroids that split apart. And it's the whole procedure that, you know, that the cure for this kind of problem, a number of different methods, they actually sell the break apart toroids that you can add, especially if, like I say, the problem is we refer to as unground, basically what you're having. Alright, I can say I got a number of questions about this, but I think, I don't know, should we go a little further with it, or let's see, the cure, like, you know, yeah, question about the ground rod. There's a company that is another one, let's see, a customer, one of the people, you know, let's see, where would I just see this one? Oh, about, I have my Radio Shack. What would you suggest I do about ground rod? Someone said to me, oh, this is another question I see from another person. I'm getting them mixed up here a little bit. This one is from Bob. Do you want to go any further with this, anything about the ground before I get into another ground question, Dick? Over.
I'd like to add a couple more words. I'm glad you mentioned the ferrite device. The Balun, if you study a Unideller or W2AU or any other brand of Balun that you normally hang at the center of the dipole, it is a chunk of ferrite that stops current from flowing down the outside of the cable. That's the ideal place to stop the common mode current right at the source, right at the antenna. You don't absolutely have to do it there. That's the best place. You can do it down the line, anywhere down the line you want. So that coil that I was telling you to add, the ideal place is at the antenna. But you can do it very soon after the rig, so to speak, before the feed line going up to the antenna. So at that place, you can put this coil of wire, the extra length of cable, and wind it into a few turns. Or you can put that ferrite device there. In other words, the Unidella Balun, you can do the equivalent of that by choosing a big enough chunk of clamshell ferrite and mounting it in that cable. I think you're going to get more bang for your dollar by the coil of coax cable. Add an extra length of cable and coil it. And you could even probably solve the problem if you've got an extra length of cable that's already there just by coiling what you got. You will be electronically changing the length of the outside of that cable, even though you didn't really physically change it. Electronically changing the length when you put it into a coil. You've made it more inductance per foot, so to speak, because of the coil. The way the magnetic field gathers around a coil will make it act like it is electronically longer, and you will most likely kill the resonance. And it does require a resonant length on the outside of that cable to give you heat, a hot RF in the shack. It doesn't happen without resonance in general, unless you're running a 50 kilowatt rig, and I think none of us are doing that yet, although we dream about it. Go on to the next round question, Mel. K2KEY, you got it.
And to Leo, Dick.
Let's hear a couple words from Rich. Go ahead, Rich.
Yeah, just, you know, Unidella makes two Balans, the W2AU and the W2DU. The AU was actually a ferrite rod with a winding on it. The W2DU is a bunch of toroids going down the center. Also, using toroids